going to talk about
two main traditions of temple architecture in India, the Nagara North Indian and the Dravida South Indian. And I'm going, I'm like Shaunika, looking over, if not thousands of years, hundreds of years, certainly at least 1500 years since temples became the kind of focus of worship, the established main focus of worship in India, and looking at the, trying to look at this theme of creativity and ask what is the creative process behind the creation of temples. How were they designed, and in some cases still are, and are they divine and or are they human? And I should at least try to show, without claiming to know, whether they ultimately they do come from God. Even if we're thinking about them as human creations, I'd like to put across the way in which the nature of the traditions and the way they develop, and the experience of the coming into being of a temple as a house for the divinity would be experienced as something that isn't to do with intellectual property and one person genius in inventing it and saying, look how clever I am, but something that is collective and which happens actually over, in many cases, across centuries. So I'm standing back and I'm looking at traditions in different parts of India, and if you look at the big picture and the forms that emerge at different times, the kind of most up-to-date forms at any one time, you see a pattern, a way of creating, which certainly doesn't start from nothing, but which starts from what's there before, and which draws out the potential of the architectural system that they've created, which goes through all the permutations and at the same time has a pattern, which is a pattern that reflects. And I'm not saying this is everywhere. It would be very dogmatic to say it all happens everywhere like that. This, I would like to say that this is very characteristic and a very striking way of in which traditions develop and through which temples are created. And if the pattern resonates with the kind of things that all the philosophies are. Actually, I think it's Samkhya philosophy that has a lot of had a lot of influence on emanatory thinking in India. The idea of one thing coming out of one thing and nothing from Prakriti interacts with Purusha, and then multiplicity comes out of unity. And of course, that sort of idea is embodied in theistic systems and expressed through mythology. So just very briefly, I won't lie on this particular table, but that way around, but Vishnu in the cosmic ocean, between one dissolution and recreation, lotus springs from his navel, grows, Brahma appears and creates the universe. So one thing comes out of something comes out of that. And you have also complicated theological systems where these gods come from that, those ones come from those. So one thing's coming out and another. And we've got a Shaivite example, Lingod Bhava, the Brahma, Vishnu arguing, Linga emerges from the void, it emerges and it grows, an orifice appears, Shiva appears, Vishnu dives down, Brahma flies up, and it's ever expanding. So emerging, expanding forms coming about through a sequence of emissions or emanations, one thing from another. And that's exactly the way these traditions characteristically develop. And I think there's something about this. It's all right, I try not to tread on the wire. Nothing comes from nothing, and it all, most of it, in its great diversity, goes back to certain prototypical shrine forms that we see in fragments and in Buddhist relief carvings, buildings made of wood, roofed with thatch, characteristic roof forms, which are like the seeds, the prototypes of different traditions all over the subcontinent, north and south. The one topped with a kuta, so the deity is in here. Could be Buddha, could be Shiva from at least going back in Gandhara, where it's Buddha, to the 2nd century AD. And then on top you have a small pavilion with a domical roof called a kuta. The similar thing, but with a shala, which is a barrel-roofed pavilion on the top. And that goes back to shrine forms and to gateways. It's a shrine and a gate. Horseshoe arch gables on the end and in the middle. A related form, also with a barrel-vaulted roof covered in thatch, which goes back, you'll know, I'm sure, the Buddhist Chaitya Hall with the nave and the side aisles, built of wood and thatch, but fossilised, as it were, in stone in the rock-cut cave temples. So we know the roof and the two side aisles, and that, whether single or like that, is another important prototype, another one, where you have multiple tiers of thatched roof going up, farmsana, what becomes the farmsana form. And a very simple form that's very important in the North Indian traditions as a kind of seed is a simple shrine with an amlaka, that ribbed fruit-like element on the top. Now, those five forms become monumentalized. They're made of wood. They've got thatched roofs, and then they're turned into stone or brick. They're revered forms. They're the houses of gods, and so they get turned into masonry to make them more permanent. And the image, that external form, is not just the decoration, it's not the ornament or it's not just mere formalism. That is the revered form of a divine abode. And that image, that form, becomes, they never go away, they get transformed, and they get combined. And the idea of the type, the temple type, the design, is one of those forms, or new forms that appear, or combinations of them. And it's the creative combination of those ingredients, ever going on, with huge creativity and invention, but nevertheless a pattern that is collectively drawn forth, that characterizes this, what we may call might call this emanatory way of creating. So I'd like to go through, obviously, all at lightning speed and looking across lots of centuries, so generalizing it, of course generalizing, but I'd like to show you the pattern first of all in the Nagara North Indian tradition, starting with its roots in the Gupta period in the Gangetic plains and in central India, where you have what you might call a proto-Nagara. There are none of these temples really existing. The temple at Deogarh, about 500 AD, didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's timed. Had one of those superstructure like this, but there are only fragments of that surviving. But there are fragments on the ground, and there are these this beautiful doorway, which has these miniature temples depicted, which give you the idea, along with a few other examples, of a type of temple which is made, which stems from this, the one with an armlocker, and then by combination of that one with this one, the Vallabhi, single or like that, builds up a composite form. So the fundamental idea is just as one God has many manifestations, or there are many subordinates to the greatest God, depending how you think of it, the temple is one house for God with many little temples, many little houses for little gods embedded and embodied within it. So you get, well, you can see this one is a fat version of that, and then it's got little ones on the corner, and it's got one of those in the middle. So one of those, it's already become the top of something else. And that's a typical ways of combining is putting something on the top of something else, and it unfolds downwards, and projecting something out from it. And you can see how emanation is already set in train. So this is really it's not using precise actual examples, but this I'm just going to show you how this developed on the basis, how the Nagara temple emerged out of this sort of proto-Nagara through a process of combining types to make new ones and a kind of emanation downward. So that Amlaka one becomes the top of a two-story one, and then you put the little ones of those on the corners, and
there is a timer,
it's a very quick timer too. don't worry. So that becomes the top of that, and then one more floor story, and then they're going down like that. Then you get that. Now all we have to do is to make these separate elements, these separate Vallabhi shrines, into one continuous spine or lata, and give it a curvature, and we get that. Which is the Latina, the early, that's the most important kind of Nagara temple in the early years, from about 7th to 10th century. Like any type that's been created, it goes on being made after that, but sinks down the hierarchy of temple forms and becomes incorporated in to more complicated forms. But first, this Latina goes through its own development. You can have more projections, and you can have more bhumis or levels. And you can see how these bhumis with their amlakas are the vestigial remains of those separate pavilions that were on the stepped pyramid of those earlier forms. They got fused into one. So one cycle has happened. Things of unity has gone into multiplicity, and then it's crystallized, fused into this, which is a single unit, though at a lower level of the hierarchy. It's got other little temples as niches with gods in them within the walls. It's going much too fast. Similarly, in parallel, that Vallabhi type, which came from this one, all of these ingredients went into that, because it's also a bit like the Farmsana, certain elements. But this Vallabhi one gets directly monumentalized in stone or brick, and itself develops in the same kind of way. If we take that example, it's a four-faced illustration of what always happens with Nagara temples. You have the Latina, and you have a Vallabhi emerging out on the front where the door is. There might be a mandapa in front of it, that. But some of them have the beautiful idea of four emerging out of one. So that's a Vallabhi temple four Vallabhi temples emerging out of the Latina temple. And the Vallabhi form, whether it's actual temples, those big ones, or the little niches in the walls of the Latina temple, they are developing in this sort of emanatory kind of way, from simple configurations to more complicated and proliferated ones. Then, by around the 9th, 10th centuries, that Latina form has, they've really more or less exhausted its possibilities, you know, given it more and more bhumis, given it more and more projections. It sort of done all the ideas that you can do with that. And a new cycle starts and it begins to proliferate again. You get Vallabhis in the middle, Kuta Stambhas, which are pillars with little shikharas on the top. And then those get combined. During the 10th century, there's a wonderful period where they're really shifting, combining all in lots of different ways, temple types which are not just single types, but they're already composite types. So that one, which is this, becomes the top of this. So that, and then one more of those becomes the top of that. The whole of that, or that one, because is the middle of that temple, you see. So this one, it's got one on each side, it's got one of them emerging out. And then in a complicated temple like this, which is the Vishvanath temple at Kachara, built around 950, you've got one of them in the middle. You've got, which already includes one of those, and you've got the whole of the top is equivalent to one of those. So you've got these different combinations, very, very rich and creative combinations of the existing material to create new things. And then especially from the 11th century onwards, you can identify a really classic example of an emanatory sequence of one form being drawn out from another and being drawn out from another, or one form emerging and emanating from another. And it starts from this basic idea of the one Latina temple with four half embedded, half emerged, which you can call them halves, but there's an imaginary other half embedded inside, and then these little shikharas on pillars, kuta stambhas, at the corner. And already it's giving the idea of something that's dynamic and emerging and expanding forms. But I think you'll already have seen that the pattern of emanation in the evolution of the tradition gives you a dynamic expression of that same sort of expansion, emergence and expansion in the individual temple. And that gets more and more powerful as it goes on, because the earlier stages are there. They're not thrown away. They're still there. You can see them inside the later stages. So you see the whole unfurling process that has happened. So this one, for a while, that's the poshest thing you can do. And then, what about this? So 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. Blah, blah, blah. So it's expanding downwards. Then 1, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And the middles come out, forward, bulging out. The corners have to go in, and you get a straight line the corners and the intermediate projections go in line. That allows you to make a whole interpenetrating, dense mesh of these things across the corner. And then, as well as these half shikaras, you get quarter ones at the side. So the idea of one with four, it happens at the lower level as well. So it's getting even more complicated and more interpenetrating. More and more forms emerging and expanding and proliferating and pouring out from that invisible point of origin. And it gets taken a stage further. But within, as with all cycles, within the rules of the game that have been set up, you kind of exhaust there's nothing else you can do unless you change the rules a bit. And that what has happened. But what you can do, which I'll show you later, is you can then the parts, the babies can have babies, the parts themselves become composite. And there are still more things you can do by changing the rules again, which they do later on. But what I've just shown you really happens between the 10th and the 12th centuries. But then they never throw anything away. They go on, you know, they go on building those whenever there's, of course, disruptions, invasions, and then things change a bit from 12th, 13th century onwards. It's hard to generalize in the same way, but the same patterns still happen, and new interesting things happen, new influences, Islamic forms getting fused and brought in, doing the same sort of things with those, having revivals as well, you know, going back to things that happened before and then trying to get more out of them. And of course, sometimes fossilized, boring repetition of what's always been done. But but repetition in itself, you know, is I think it's quite clear. It's not as in, you know, plagiarizing. It's just not a concept. You know, of course, you start from what there is, and you know, the culture as a whole, the tradition, is creative, is endlessly creative with it. So that's that sequence of forms, and if you can either go that way or that way, but you really can, if you stand back and you look, you know, keep them in your head, you can see one coming out of another, one born out of another. So if we take the Kandariya Mahadeva temple, which has already done, you know, most of the things you can do in the middle of the 11th century at Khajuraho, it's in such a way that you've got the four from one coming at two levels. You've got these quarter shringas, quarter shikaras up here. Sorry, it's not very clear. And again, down here. So if we look at the dynamics of it, it's growing like this. And this is both the expression of movement in that temple, but it's also the traces of the steps of evolution of the tradition, which are embodied in it. So that's how the temple actually is. If you go there to Khajuraho and go there to go and see it, buy your postcard, go and look at it, that's what you can see. But if you look further, where is all this going? And it seems to be that where they conceptually are going is in the very process of being manifested and coming into being, the individual forms are already on their way towards dissolution back into an undifferentiated unity from which a new cycle will begin. And as I said, when you've done pretty well everything with that, then the parts proliferate. And these kuta stampas are no longer single latinus shikaras. They themselves are complex anekandaka or shikari compositions. Now, in front of a temple like that, you'll often get a mandapa roof, which in the early days would have been farmsana, and then becomes what's called in Western Central India, becomes samvarana, which is a kind of proliferated farmsana. And then underneath you'll see a corbelled ceiling like this, which looks very lotus-like or flower-like, which it is, but its element, like the exterior of the temple, its elements are actually imagery of architecture. So the basic unit, which you find as a single entity in earlier ceilings, is actually the underside of a thatched domed roof with wooden ribs running up to it, made into stone. And it grows lobes, and as the tradition develops, things go like that.
Yeah.
And then what do you do? The babies have babies, the lobes have lobes. And you can imagine it going on forever. But if you go on forever, things get so little, and you know, you've got to start and do something. Again, do something else. So that's a broad picture of the Nagara North Indian tradition. What about in the South? The basic elements are that early shrine form with a kuta, a domed pavilion, and the one with the barrel-roofed shala. And the simplest thing to do is to make one of those as your temple. So these are from the Chola period, but they go back earlier. That's very typical. It's a square-domed kuta. That's what you see here. But you can also have the same thing with a shala, or an apsidal ended shala, as you see here, and it can either be the whole of the temple, which is a particular shape, or the bottom can be square or rectangular, but the top could be circular or apsidal or rectangular or octagonal. You can see the pilasters in the wall, which are stone representations of what were originally wooden posts, whereas the simplest shrine would just have four at the corners, it has to have a garbhagriha, a sanctum with a deity inside, has to be a fat proportion, so you have very often four pilasters in the wall. And the mouldings that you see here are all ultimately derived from wood, so that is the joist. Well, that is a thatched canopy on which the kuta pavilion sat. This one is the ends of the floor joists, the wooden floor. Then you have the vedi, which is a railing, and then the neck, the griva, and then the shikara, which is the roof. So to develop this idea, they combine these elements in different ways. So that very often is the top. It's a single temple, or it's the top of a more complicated one. And then you can get two, three, four talas or stories. And usually these ones are on the corner and these ones in the middle, and they're not just the ornament, they are images of temples which are embedded within the body of the main temple. So from an early date, the essential ingredients are the kuta edicule, the one with a kuta on top, the one with a shala on top. And if you turn the shala round, You've got the horseshoe gable on the end, and that gives you what's called a panjara, a cage. And that gives you a third edicule, or image of a building, with, as an ingredient. Or you can make those one more floor. That gives you another type. And then you can combine all these together in lots of different ways, different numbers of stories, different edicules, different scales, combining them in different ways. And the basic range will go from the single story up to five. It can also, in the Brihadishvara Tanjavur, you've got 14. But the Dravida tradition of the far south of Tamil Nadu is, in a way, it's one of those traditions we should use to qualify the emanatory way of designing. I don't want to say it's absolutely universal, and it's less prominent there. The idea of emanation, obviously, is very prominent. That Shiva Linga statue I showed you at the beginning, the pilaster splitting and stuff, all of that. But if you the development of Dravida temples in Tamil Nadu is hugely creative and varied, but it's not, you know, going from simple to complex through the centuries. If we want to see another classic emanatory evolution of Dravida forms, we have to go to Karnataka and to the Deccan, where we can see exactly those same ingredients, same origins, same early stages, and then they go on transforming. They go on drawing one from another, from simple to complex. And the overall pattern going from this around the 7th to around the 13th century is like that. And I will show you it in a bit more detail. You end up with something like that, which, if you're from Tamil Nadu, you'll say that's not a Dravida temple. And even if you're a sort of American art historian, you'll say this is not a Dravida. It's now a new form called Vesara, which names, we won't go into name terminology, but you can call it Vesara, which means a mule, a hybrid. But in fact, some scholars have seen it as intellectual property, kind of a model of creation. You know, the genius, the radical, innovative 10th century architects, they weren't happy with Dravida. They wanted to do something innovative, and so they changed it, blah, blah, blah. Now, I'm not denying the creativity of the huge ingenuity of the artists, but I don't agree with that model of it, because if you look across the centuries, you see this gradual transformation. It's not one day to the next. They're not throwing away anything. Nothing comes from nothing. The mouldings are being transformed, and the overall form is being transformed in the ways I shall just show you. In particular, let's focus to begin with on this central element. Remember, that was the shala, the barrel-roofed thing. Well, in the 10th century, they start to do this. They say, well, let's put a panjara, one of them, in the middle of that, projected out. Right, so you've got that. And having done that, well, what you do next, of course, you do that. So you have got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of those shalas interpenetrating and emerging out one from another. And of course, in the wall, it's stepping forwards. And that's just the central element. But meanwhile, the plan of the temple is starting with a simple flat wall, then it's getting projections with recesses between, then it's getting more and more projections with more and more stepping out. So it gives you, you come to this, which looks like that. So the overall pattern is like this. So this gets another floor, another story, putting little pavilions on the top, giving it on the top of the first stage, giving it projections. And then you're starting to do this kind of thing. Then that becomes the top of that. And at some indefinable moment, you know, you can't say this was Dravida, this was Vesara. It's an organic process. And then you get the star shaped. I'll look at it a little more. So that's the sort of just before you start getting the star shaped ones. In a little bit more detail, you've got this face, Kirtimukh monster face, and the arch is coming out of its mouth like that. And you've got one of them on the end, either end, and you've got the bodies, snail-like bodies of those going along. And then just to make it a bit more dynamic, then let's have a face, an arch, and then another face, and then another arch, and then another face, and so radiating down, cascading down the sloping sides of the tower. Then the makaras, those floor joists that I mentioned, they used to be, and there are vialas, there were makaras on the corner. At first they're like that, or you get a viala and a makara, and then you get the two makaras like that. And then you get a diagonal one between, that's here, a diagonal one here, and again here, and then they all go diagonal. And then, meanwhile, this face and all that stuff, that also goes diagonal. So the monster starts looking this way, and the arch is coming like that. So, so what's happening is, you know, this is happening. It's bulging out. The centre is getting more and more out, and then you get these diagonal forces, and whoosh, the uniform stellate plan. Very popular with the Hoysalas. Hoysala dynasty in southern Karnataka, who took on this Karnata Dravida tradition and did it in a very elaborate way. I'll come on to it again in a moment, but still this is northern Karnataka, late Chalukyan. They're also aware of northern Indian forms. So in the miniature temples that they're building in the walls of their Vimanas, they're doing Shekhari and Bhumija and all these northern Nagara forms, and as well as their own Dravida, Karnata Dravida ones, and they're even combining the two in inventive ways. So that's actually a Bhumija form with a Dravida form emerging from it. So this simple idea of one temple coming out of another is so, you know, so fertile, and it's happening all over the place and making new things everywhere. But always new things, not coming out of nothing, make new things out of things that already exist in an emanatory kind of way. As a little aside, I'll mention one of the temple designs I've been involved in, which is still going. It's in Karnataka, east of Bangalore, actually not in the Hoysala area itself, which is Halebid, Belur, all that, which is west of Bangalore. But the clients want to build an authentic Hoysala temple. That's a 12th century temple, new one, made out of soapstone, hand-carved. They don't want a copy, so that which is I'm very pleased about. They first were in touch with me about, it's been going on a long time, about 8 or 9 years ago. This is Halibid, the famous temple of Halibid. So they want, this is what is going to be a revival of the glorious Hoysala style. This is five or six years ago. I've designed this thing, and a Tamil Stapati, who are the traditional Tamil temple builders. They don't do this kind of temple, which is why they asked me. But they do, you know, they are holders of the Dravida tradition, and they're builders too. They have the building knowledge. So that's this Shankar Stapati is going to be the contractor and build the temple. I've done the overall drawings, and I've got to do still a lot of detailed drawings. And I'm telling you about it because I tried to take an approach which was not the genius coming along and designing something, but to let it come grow out from the tradition. Let it be Svayambhu, self-creating, which I think that emanatory kind of thing, phenomenon I've been trying to show you, that's how you experience it. You know, the if you're designing a temple and the tradition is there, you're using the ingredients of it. It has this sort of system of and way of doing things. You can do all kinds of stuff with it, but somehow it has its own potential to do. It's not predestination, but in retrospect, you can say they had, having done that, they kind of had to do that because it's sort of organic, and you would. It almost seems like a cosmic process, as well as mirroring all these ideas about how cosmic creation and universal order are. It's actually, I think, the doing of it would be experienced that way. And of course, the ritual, I'm just talking about the architecture, you know, how you design it. All the rituals would be reinforcing these kind of things. There's certainly anthropological work in South India that I was struck by. Sam Parker's done quite a lot of work where he's looking at the way Stapatis and clients work together, you know, kind of in parallel with the capitalistic system that's also there now, of course, the individualism and this is mine. But he argues, you know, through ethnographic study that the experience and the shared understanding is that the temple's kind of creating itself, and you're not imposing your will on it. So I thought, well, I'll have it because of the way I feel by looking and observing that the way I feel these traditions develop is going in this particular way. What about, you know, see what you can do next with it? And that seemed to be what the client was wanting. And he did point me to particular examples like, you know, R.C. Carey and so certain things. So I'm trying to see what comes up, just comes out. And they wanted to have an open dancing pavilion in front, like something like that. That's R.C. Carey Temple. This had to be the size of Belor Temple. Okay, but that looks a bit funny. Do you mean the middle of Belor? Yes, so that becomes bigger. It's all much bigger. It's ever so big that maybe that's why it's not built yet. And so you can't just do that. The beam span is going to, you know, requires you to do that. And the actual form of the exterior did seem to come about in a remarkably Svayambhu sort of way, in that they wanted the Dasavatar of Vishnu around the mandapa. It's a Sri Venkateshvara Balaji temple, so Vaishnava temple. So you needed 10 equal niches that you need to walk around with all the Dashavatar in them. So that created your mandapa walls. And then for the Vimana, which of course is the more complicated bit, they wanted the Vishnu Chaturvimshati, the 24 glorious names of Vishnu, which means that you've got to have, it's got to be stellate, Hoysala temple, but it doesn't mean 24 points. It happens to end up as 24 points, that's because you have to have 24 visible facets, if you like, with 24 forms of Vishnu on them. And because they want these big central projections, that's hiding some, and of course this is hiding some. So 24 points you've actually got. If it was a free cosmic symmetrical thing, it would have 48 facets, but 24 of them are hidden. So it gives you as if inevitably that, and because of the 24, this is going beyond what they had done before. You've got to have these seven talas to get the proportions right. So that sort of imposes itself. And then they said, well, we want something more like Belur in these things coming out. So they got those. So that's the temple that designed itself. Still, I need to help it a bit with some more details. And that's the whole thing with the open dancing pavilion. And that's the ambitious prakara with Hoysala style gopuram, which never happened in history, which I'm looking forward to designing. And this was last June, where finishing off the first stone for the Maharaja of Mysore to lay. He came, and there he is, and he did the ceremony for it. There is a platform made of granite on which it's being built. First stone is there. There's quite a few more stones to do, and it isn't being totally swayambhu as it should, because they've still got to collect a lot more money before it's finished. But when they have, it will finally have created itself and look something like that. So, which brings us to the last bit, where I'd like to talk to you about the role of texts in all of this. That is the Vastu Shastra texts, the architectural treatises, Shilpa Shastra texts on craftsmanship, Vastu Shastra texts on Vastu or architecture. Now, these are you. I've been going into these a lot, collaborating with Sanskritists in the last sort of 10 years or so. Before that, I thought, they're nothing to do, and I'm not alone in thinking that. A lot of people think they're nothing to do with the actual buildings. Or else they think the opposite extreme, these are sacred texts and everything must be said in the text and the building must be doing, because it's sacred, that they must be following, it must be telling you exactly how to do it, and if you do it wrong, then you'll go to hell for 60,000 years and things like that. But it's when I found that by looking at them and working on the Sanskrit texts, it's very much to do with the temple designs, and you can actually extract the design with a lot of work. If you know the tradition, you know the architectural language, you can draw the temples that they're talking about. But it's not like a recipe. Well, it's only like a recipe, and it gives you a framework. You've still got to do the thing. It gives you some ingredients. But it's not a straitjacket. It's not a rigid thing. It gives you this framework, and you've then got to fill in all the details and do the bits it didn't tell you, and very often you've got to improvise and invent. So it makes you create something you wouldn't have done otherwise, And of course, it also gives you the sense, or everyone involved, the sense that it's coming from a divine source, or anyway a suprahuman source. You're not sitting down and doing it out of nothing. You're passing it on through the tradition, or even you're just reading it and you're trying to, or reciting it, and it's not all relying on you to be the genius, and yet you'll probably create something much better than you would have done if you had just sat down and said, "I'm a genius." And so, in that way, the texts can play their part in the Svayambhu self-creatingness of temples. And there's another way in which they all fit into this picture. They aren't always talking about there are a lot of temple types which do exist that they talk about. They also extrapolate and think of new types which may not have been built, which may one day have been built, or which may one day never be built, and which would make you, and if you try to do one of those, you do something very amazing. And they also have this emanatory way of thinking. That's very, very striking. They're usually talking about sequences of temples, not individual ones. Occasionally, they're really explicit. There's a chapter in the Samarangana Sutradhara of the 11th century, which I think is an older bit of material of text incorporated in that, which talks about a particular type of temple being a kula, or a family clan, a clan, and it says the temples, they have sons, and this type of temple has sons and grandsons and great grandsons, so they're giving birth to one another. But you know, even when it doesn't say that, it doesn't say an emanatory way of thinking is typical in Indian thought, and this is why we're going to do it. Of course, it doesn't say that kind of stuff, but it does. It does have these sequences that, where you draw out, even when you're reading the text, you go through it. You have to draw. No good just reading it. It's asking you. It's for architects, or even if it's for sort of dilettantes who want to understand it. It's not saying go and hew this stone and drag it up the hill and then get a chisel. It's about conceptual designs, and the drawing is the intermediary between the words and the doing. And then you've got to get the stone, and you've got to make it, and get a whole lot of people carving it. And you know, so nothing's predetermined. It comes out through the process. Let me just give you one or two examples of the kind of sequence. There's one sequence that starts with a temple called Kesari. You find it in several texts, which is unusual. But this is one that actually goes through, it actually does evolve through the centuries and catch up with the evolving traditions as things develop, which is quite unusual. But it starts with the earliest one that seems to exist of this series is in the Samarangana Sutradhara of the 11th century. And it starts from this temple called the Kesari, which I've already shown you. It's that, and one of them, and that. And that has, it has five andakas. The andakas are the amlakas on top of the shikaras. So it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Five of them. And the game it plays is that you've got to go from 5 to 101 through 25 temples, and you've got to add 4 andakas each time. So this one, I already showed you, that's that one. So it's then. So you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Navandaka, 9 andakas. I'll show you the sequence in a minute. I think I've got in here, I've got that one, which is outside the sequence, but where this one's called Sarvatobhadra. Don't think that every time you hear about Sarvatobhadra it means that, because the same sort of names are used in different texts from different times to mean completely different temple types. So don't get hung up on the terminology. But in this particular series, that does happen in several texts across the centuries, it does have the same, more or less the same names, Kesari, Sarvasvamudra, and it means that. And then this one where you've got all these, it tells you there are lots of Sarvasvamudras in this, and Vallabhi's in the middle. And it's a very, very complicated one, which nobody ever built. And it's a good example of how, if you did sit down to build it, you'd have to think of all the things they haven't told you, and it would be amazing. I'd love to build one of them one day. Here's the sequence from the first two, Kesari, Sarvasvamudra. You get 25. I've just drawn, I always try to draw what the text tells you not to add all the details. You know, you could say, I'd like to try and look clever and add all the mouldings and stuff, but I'm just trying to show you what it says. And this particular text is just giving you the bare bones, giving you certain proportions and dimensions. What always happens is you start from a plan, tells you how many squares, how many parts in the plan. It can be 8, 12, 22, all kinds of numbers. Don't believe it's all Vastu Purush Mandala, 8 by 8. That's a ritual for the site, but it's not that every single temple plan in the world is a Vastu. It's actually separate from the temple plan, despite all the books saying that, you know, that they're all, it's all a Vastu Purush Mandala. But you've got, this one's got 12, for example. You start with it, it'll tell you that this corner is this much, this is this much. It'll tell you the size of each of the parts, and then you, having got the plan, you go up to the top, and you have to, you know, you puzzle it out, and then finally, bingo, it clicks, and that's what they're talking about. So remember, we've got to add 5 andakas each time. So I'll just show you 4 or 5 of them. You've got to so you do things like you take away, you know, the grey one is the bit they've added on. But if we want 4, if we want 4 more, what do we do? You've got to take that away and to put from the text. You realise they're talking about that, and then you can check it because you can count the andakas. This is from a date where it's that time where I was telling you about where they were combining lots of different sorts of already composite temples into one. And that's kind of reflected in the text where they say, oh, look, there's a Sarvasvamudra in the middle now, and that kind of thing. They're naming other temple types which are in the new types. Another version of that text appears in the Aparajita Pritcha in the 12th century, I thought you were going to tell me to hurry up.
Yeah.
I am hurrying. 5 minutes. I was very pleased because, as you would expect, you can find some more complicated temples in the 12th century one, where they're starting this sequence, and they've got these quarter shikharas that I mentioned, these ones. So the Indranila in the Samaranga Sutradhara is like that, and the Indranila, which is the 13th of the series, when you look in the Aparajita Pratcha, it's like that. I need to explain, I've only drawn the front on here. I've drawn the sides on here, so sorry. But anyway, there you have the quarter ones. You can even draw the roof plan if you. The text isn't telling you the roof plan, but it tells you all this, and then it tells you what goes on each of these. And if you, you know, to know that you haven't done it wrong, it actually has to work as a 3D thing, you know. So you've got to. Draw. It's not vague. It's all there. And there it is. It's like one of these which you get typically in the 12th century. Not quite the same geometry, but nearly. So nearly there. Just by contrast, I could have used the Bhumija temple as an example that doesn't evolve in that kind of organic way, because it can be orthogonal or it can be stellate, because it's one which they actually invented around the turn of the 11th century. Not out of nothing. They used the ingredients of the Nagara tradition with some knowledge of Dravida. And so, but rather than a gradual evolution of, through which this form emerged, you can see it suddenly appears. And it appears at the same time as that Samarangana Sutradhara text. I'm quite convinced they were working out the theory and the practice at the same time. And once you, it's not a complicated idea. You have these going up and you have this coming there. But the number of projections, the number of stories, and whether it's orthogonal, whether it's stellate, it's kind of there. Once you've thought of it, the possibilities are there. They don't build all of them, all of the possibilities. In fact, certain ones become popular. It is much closer to practice in proportions and things than a lot of other traditions because of this theory and practice being worked out at the same time. So you can take this type and you can look at the drawing at Bhojpur, where I've redrawn the drawing. There are these 11th century drawings on the rock, and they're very big and they're all worn out. But if you draw, you know, you can redraw them. And that is a Bhumija Shikara, and you can study the proportions that it says in the text, and it's not exactly the same, but the principles, like taking a quarter off each time and dividing by having 10 squares and then redividing by 12, and this is being 2, 1.5, 5, it's really close. In fact, if you didn't have the text, you'd go and you'd say, sacred geometry, I'm going to look for the golden section. You might find the golden section, but probably not. But, you know, you'd be saying this is all equilateral triangles or something because it's, you know, it's sacred geometry and it's the same everywhere. But it ain't the same everywhere. This is much more modular. And if you're looking at the text, that tells you what, let's have a look at this and try it out. And it works, I promise. But I was talking about sequential emergence and all of that, and I was merely wanting to put this one in, these Bhumija temples in, just to say they didn't evolve in that sequential kind of way. They thought of the theory and the practice at the same time, but they did nevertheless think in an emanatory kind of way, and a different kind from the one in that mainstream Nagara tradition where one temple form is sort of bodily, bodied forth physically out of another form. But there are different kinds of logics in different traditions, different ways of thinking. And this one is very, very rigorous and mathematical. And you've got the numbers of projections, you've got the number of bhumis, and the proportions. It's you've got this very, very logical sequence. When you get to the star-shaped ones, you've got a way of dividing the big circle into a number of smaller ones, which give you the points of the star. And if you're starting with a number, in this case 10, and this is 2¾, and when you work it out within, I even got a mathematician friend who helped me, and he said within point that 2½ does actually go around, is in this case 20 times, that's 16. Anyway, there are certain types of little circle in relation to the number of squares in the number of parts in the big circle that go in an exact number of times. There's 16, 20, 28, 24, 28, 32, all of those things. And they go through all those, you know, they do it for all of those. And they get this, from the square types, the star-shaped types, and the Ashtabhadra, which have 8 bhadras, they go through the whole thing. So it's a different sort of emanatory sequence, but nevertheless it's the same way of thinking one thing coming from another, one from another one, another one coming from that. And finally, I think this takes 4 minutes, and it will tell you everything I told you about the Nagara tradition in 4 minutes. It's a video that I worked on for the British Museum for an exhibition they had in Shanghai. And is the sound?
You have to plug everything in. Let's see.
Yeah. Never mind. I can sing it. It's got music.
But, and QuickTime is the program to run.
QuickTime's the program to run it. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's that sort of traffic cone thing, you know.
Yeah, it's not downloaded onto that computer.
So. No, that it isn't. Too bad. I could hold up my laptop just with it on. Too bad. Never mind.
Okay.
Never mind. It just shows you. I've been trying to show you these things by jumping around and through drawings, and even the wonders of PowerPoint can't fully show you. But the computer animation is a little bit more helpful in that it shows you. If you had seen it, would just point out that it's showing you the stages of growth of a tradition. At the same time, the dynamic pattern which is there in the individual temple, which embodies those stages of growth. That nothing is coming out of nothing; it's all being drawn out from what was already there, and that it's cyclical. And when every end has the seeds of a new beginning. Thank you.